First of all, I would like to understand why is the environmental crisis crisis of ideas. It's one of the things you say in your...
I think it's a crisis of ideas because we have structured our relationship on in relation to the environment on the basis of our understanding of what the natural world is about and who we are as human beings in relation to the natural world. This conditions the way we manipulate it, the way we live in it, the way we exploit it. And so the environmental crisis, I like to think, is nature's resistance to the way we have treated it. It's almost as if it's an agent that is pushing back with pollution and climate change and all of the things that we call the environmental problem. It's nature's way of talking back to us that we don't really understand the natural world. We don't understand our place in it. So it's a crisis of ideas because it is these assumptions that we've made, which are essentially philosophical, conceptual assumptions, that are the context of our dealings with the environment, which have resulted in, of course, many wonderful things, but also many untoward and problematic things. And so we have to change the way we think before we can change the way we act and the way we behave.
And how can we change the way we think?
How can we change the way we think? That's a very difficult problem. The first thing is that we have to bring out into the open, so to speak, the way we have thought, because most of these structuring ideas that organize our world are implicit. They're unconscious. We're much more aware of the surface of things than the deep structures of our thinking. So the first task is to call these out for criticism, for examination. For example, we have to ask ourselves, is nature structured as we have believed, like a machine that we can sort of manipulate its parts? That's the sort of thing that we don't think about every day, but philosophers can kind of penetrate the surface and shine a light on these deeper assumptions. And then we can, once we bring them out into the open, then we begin to examine them critically and say, well, is the world really just a sort of passive material that we can reshape the way we want? That's been what we have assuming. We're getting some messages back from the world that's not the way it really works. And so the first task then is shining a light, is bringing to the surface, criticizing these ideas. Then the second task, and by far the harder one, is to say, well, how can we change? And there are various suggestions by environmental philosophers about how this may be done. There are some old ideas in our history of philosophy that have been forgotten. Maybe we can see if we can't bring those around to the fore. What about...
Can you give me an example?
Yes, an example of that would be that in the in former times, rather than think of the Earth as a mechanical system, it was thought of as an organic system. The the old idea of Mother Earth. It's not an invention of hippies in the 1960s. It goes back to the ancient Greeks and to medieval philosophy and so on. And so maybe one thing we could do is to say, well, we used to think of the Earth more like a big organism rather than a big machine. And so perhaps, you know, we could bring that idea back. Then our dominant, globally dominant worldview is really European, I mean, in its origins. There are a number of other traditions of thought, philosophies in India and China and Japan and among, let's say, American Indian people, indigenous traditions of thought. Maybe they have some ideas that we have, in our arrogance, overwhelmed, and perhaps if we pay more attention to their worldview, their philosophies, we might be able to develop, we might be find ways of thinking about nature. I don't think you could just sort of appropriate, but they give us some ideas, you know, that we might be able to utilize. Now, my preferred approach, however, is neither of these. I think that at the previous turn of the century, between the 19th and the 20th century, there was a second scientific revolution, the theory of relativity, quantum theory, and this most amazing new science emerged just at that time called ecology, which enabled us to think about our environment as more like a community of interacting individuals that were all connected to one another in very elaborate systems of relationships. And so when you manipulate one thing, it has repercussions throughout the whole system. And so it's been my approach to say that we have not really paid sufficient attention to the novelty of these new scientific ideas, that they have tremendous philosophical and ethical significance. And hey, guess what? They're also the current state of science, and science has a certain authority in our culture. And so rather than trying to bring in these ideas from other cultures or look back in our past and revise some previous ideas, we have in front of us right now the newest, latest thinking in this very sophisticated, very respected intellectual sector that we call science. And if we philosophers can bring to light the new assumptions about the nature of nature, human nature, and the relationship, then we can perhaps, these will, I like to say, sort of leak into our general world view and change our consciousness about our human relationship with nature and the way nature is organized and structured. So that's the approach that I have tried to develop in my philosophy.
Aren't you sometimes a bit desperate by seeing the all political leaders going in another way?
Yes. Back when Ronald Reagan was elected president of the United States in 1980, this followed a decade of ecological consciousness raising in the United States. The Endangered Species Act, the Environmental Protection Act, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, all of these were enacted in the 1970s during the Nixon administration. Then Ronald Reagan was the candidate for president who said, if you've seen one redwood tree, you know, the magnificent redwoods on the West Coast, you've seen them all. And oh, by the way, trees cause pollution. So that was a real disappointment. Mm-hmm. But at the time I thought, well, this is just the conservatives having their last dance. You know, we'll, Reagan comes along and then we will return to an enlightened state of consciousness, but it didn't happen. And even when we look back today from the perspective of our current politics, Richard Nixon, who's driven out of office, looks like a statesman and a great president in comparison to the lot we have now. And George Bush, of course, is even worse than Reagan. So, does it cause me some despair? Indeed, it does.
Which George Bush do you talk about?
The first one was, at least he had some education and, mm-hmm. and had a sense of public spiritedness and was a sane man. I mean, his son was what I call militantly mm-hmm. ignorant, someone who is ignorant, proud, and refuses to change his state of mind. So he was the low point so far in the American presidency. But why do I remain hopeful and optimistic? Because things change, and I just came from Paris, and I was attending a conference in the Sorbonne, and I'm thinking, okay, in the 17th century, not that long ago, the Sorbonne was inhabited by the scholastic philosophers who were still in the Aristotelian and Thomist tradition. Galileo was under house arrest for saying that the earth moves. And Descartes couldn't get a job as an academic because he wasn't part of the official scholastic tradition. These were the intellectual outlaws and new creative thinkers. And Descartes has this dream of a new science that will enable mankind to master nature. Well, at the time it must have looked hopeless, with the church still having the world under its thumb, the Pope ruling from the Vatican, the academic environment completely hostile to the new philosophy, and yet, well, here we are. Descartes' dream has become a nightmare, but but it was realized. Nevertheless, so I like to think on the long term, and that what philosophers do, like Descartes, and I like to think of myself as being a colleague of theirs, not of the contemporary scholastics, which occupy the Sorbonnes and the Harvards and the Stanford universities and so on of the world, that what we are doing in environmental philosophy philosophy of the future and will actually change the world. I mean, I think big, and I have big ambitions, and I think that eventually we will prevail, because culture never remains static, and I think false ideas simply have a way of eventually defeating themselves. They resist it. They seem permanently ensconced, but eventually they go away.
But in the same time, we can see some movements, especially in the United States, like climate skeptical people and also creationists.
Yes. forgive me
and
for putting
think
it this
they
way.
Will prevail also.
I'm about to use a Texasism. I could say, honey, you're absolutely right about that. I live in the belly of the beast in Texas. There are people who think that climate change is taking place, but not because of human agency. There are people who think that climate change is a hoax drummed up by liberals so that they can have their top-down command control sort of government and deprive ordinary people of their mechanized recreation and their big sport utility vehicles. You're familiar with these and pickup trucks. I mean, every young man in Texas thinks that his manhood depends on driving a pickup truck. So there's have a horse. There are people who believe that climate change is part of the end times. Do you know what that is? The fundamentalist religion thinks that the world, the end of the world, is around the corner, and so far from wanting to stop it, actually encourage this because it's part of the apocalypse. And so I'm familiar with the syndrome, and also, of course, opposition to the theory of evolution. And there's some astonishing actual polls that show that nearly 50% of Americans do not accept the theory of evolution. They believe the world is 6,000 years old. It was created by God, just as it was described in the Bible. So it's it certainly does provide anyone who wants to be cynical and pessimistic with every reason to be so. On the other hand, you might look at it this way, that these responses, there are two things. One is where climate change is concerned, it's actually part of a disinformation campaign on the part of the oil companies. It's like the tobacco companies.
Heartland Institute is
an example of that. And the tobacco companies actually tried to convince people that smoking was not injurious to your health and so on, and they put a lot of money into it. The oil companies are doing exactly the same thing where climate change is concerned. So part of it is simply a kind of corporate conspiracy or calumny. But I think the other part is based on a visceral sense that the world is changing and that there's fear of change and that it's darkest before dawn and that there's a desperate clinging to these safe beliefs. We want the world to be just like it was in 1955. But we know that it's changing, and so it's almost like if we fervently believe in the Bible and in a stable planet or environment, then we can make it so by just sort of wishing it to be that way. And one of the more disturbing things that's happening, I think, in U.S. politics is that a religious epistemology has set in. And by religious epistemology, I mean, if religious person, you have faith, and your faith is not tractable to any contrary evidence. Evidence is irrelevant to your beliefs. And increasingly I hear our politicians, not about climate change and environmental things, but about, say, economic policy and so on, they say, these are our beliefs. We believe in lower taxes and smaller government and all of that, as if it were a religion, rather than a rational, practical sort of governmental and financial policy. That, to me, is extremely disturbing. That religion and politics has been so closely allied in the United States that the epistemology of the one is starting to infect the other. And that's an even more systemic kind of worry that I have. But again, taking the long view, I rather think that the one certainty we have in looking at past history is that the ideas that seem so entrenched now are in the future no longer viable, even eventually forgotten. And if we look at the sort of things that were capturing people's imagination, which they were debating in the past, or seemed to us like tempests and teapots about really nothing at all, and we've moved on from that. And the present is no different from that. So it's just hard for us to see this movement because we're watching it day by day, year by year, whereas if we look at it in terms of centuries, well, you know, things will be different. There's no doubt about it. Now, whether they'll be better or worse is another matter. And that's where I think what I call desperate optimism comes into play, that what we philosophers can do and need to do is to try to steer change in positive directions. Change is inevitable. So what direction will it take? And that is what I think our calling as philosophers is to try to settle and ride this beast that we call culture and civilization as it gallops towards the future.
And how far can we go in the manipulation of the nature?
That's actually a very good question. I am pausing because I want to think about it very hard. One response would be to say, well, we can't go very far. We should not be manipulating nature. We should let nature take its course. We should back off. But that really assumes a very obsolete separation of man from nature. It's as if we're space aliens and nature is the system that exists apart from us and takes its own course unless we manipulate it. So I think that we're part nature, we're in it. And every organism changes and transforms nature, some more visibly and dramatically than others, but all have their impact and their contribution. So I don't think it's a question so much as how much, it's what kind of manipulation of nature can we and should we do that is successful. example of that, we have a very successful kind of industrial and commercial economy, but clearly its impact on the environment is such that the environment will no longer be able to support those kinds of manipulations. So we need to think about how to manipulate nature in a way that is consistent with its own principles, that is takes advantage of its own momentum and processes. I sometimes like to think of this as a kind of technological judo, where you don't resist the forces of nature, you employ them to your own and direct them to ways that are advantageous to our own society, but that are, well, the watchword here is sustainable. And sustainable in two senses, that is to say that we can continue to do this, that it is not short term, and that it does not exhaust or cause the natural world to react against us and push back as our previous manipulations have done. So there's no getting around manipulation, and it's not so much of what, how much, but of what kind and what quality that we have. And so one of the things that Laurent and his philosophy of management are doing, and the sorts of examples that he uses are like the cradle-to-cradle process, which is basically a sort of cyclical or recycling, because that's the way nature works. And biomimicry, where we study the nature's solutions to problems that organisms have had, that have had millions of years to come up with the optimum solution through the process of evolution and imitate that. So I think that we see clear signs, not from the politicians, but from the entrepreneurs who are beginning to rethink the world, have a new conception, philosophy of nature, and then to apply this in their business, industrial and commercial practices. So that's where the leadership really is going to come from. The politicians, I mean, they're whores, really, in every sense of the word, both to their financiers and to the lowest common denominator of their constituents, you know, so.
That's what you call the adaptation of the human economy to the economy of nature?
Yes. Okay. The adaptation of the human economy to the economy of nature. The economy of nature is one of the oldest metaphors in ecology. And I think it's just now being, we are now understanding that the human economy is a subset of the economy of nature. It's embedded in it, and therefore it has to fit in it in a harmonious way. But one of the things I've been thinking about lately is the way that the way that we understand the human economy can also help us to understand the economy of nature. Ecology has been a very dynamic science, and it has gone through a number of paradigm shifts, as we say. In other words, the natural world was conceived under one model, and then that model has been criticized and rejected. And then another model comes along, and so on. And now I think that the science itself is very ripe for rethinking this old notion of the economy of nature. And that's because our free market economies are self-organizing systems that we have functions in the economy. We have transportation, and we have healthcare, and we have agriculture, and the energy sector, and all of that. But none of the entrepreneurs were thinking, oh, I'm going to perform this public service for the benefit of the society. They were thinking about what economic opportunity can I exploit to make a living and to do well for myself and my family. But as people are thinking in terms of their own self-interest, the whole economy begins to take shape as a coherent system, and then we can identify these important functions. Well, that's the way we are beginning to think. That ecological scientists are beginning to think about the economy of nature. It's no longer thought to be these independent structures, ecosystems, and so on, that rather these systems emerge from the various activity of the individual players and begin to take shape in that way. And also, human economies are hierarchically organized, not in the bureaucratic sense of a hierarchy, but in the Chinese box sense. There, one is nested in a larger system. And so we can isolate certain structures in the human economy, for example, the economy of Brussels, which is then part of the larger economy of Belgium, which is part of the larger economy of Europe, which is part of the global economy. But in each case, there are very porous boundaries that separate this hierarchically organized system of the economic systems. And we have the same idea that is very relevant now to ecosystems. They can be organized in a hierarchical way, depending to some extent on what our interests are. I mean, if the interest of the mayor of Brussels is in the economy of Brussels, and he cares less about the economy of Belgium, but nevertheless has to pay attention to what's going on in the larger economy of Belgium in order to take advantage of whatever opportunities there are for the Brussels economy and so on. But looking at it from a different angle, you might not be able to make these distinctions, and that's the way we are thinking about the world in ecology. And so I think that ecologists have as much to learn from economics as people in the business world with an economic background have to learn from ecology. So it's a two-way street. And that to me is very exciting, because I think that rather than that for people in management and business and entrepreneurs, they don't want to be preached to by ecologists. They want to have a partnership and, a two-way flow of information. So I think it results in a much healthier partnership between the science on the one hand and the economic community on the other.
You said previously it's something different, that nature is resistant. Really?
Oh yes, nature is resistant. It's metaphorically speaking, the environmental problems that we face represent, we can metaphorically represent them as the resistance of nature. Do you see what I mean? In other words, we're going along with our industrial economy, and suddenly we realize that it's causing severe dislocations through natural systems. Well, in a way, that's of course unconscious. I mean, that's just what happens. But we can. I think it helps us if we can personify nature as pushing back against this. It dramatizes the situation, and it makes for a better sense of how to engage it. In this case, is if we're dealing with, and these are not just my thoughts, by the way. I'm reflecting some work by Bruno Latour and Michel Serre. Preceded Latour in this regard. Latour talks about the agence of nature, the agency of nature. But of course, it's metaphorical. On the other hand, there is agency in the animal world that we haven't really given enough credit to the animals for having agency. We thought of them as Cartesian automata, just systems of stimulus and response, but they're thinking too. They're responding. But of course, nature at large is not an animal. It doesn't have a consciousness. It's not pushing back in any deliberate way, but we can project a personality on it and think of it this way because it helps focus our thinking on what our problems are.
One thing that seems to me very important and you did not really touch upon is the idea of the importance of the biotic community and of the need to consider an extension of ethics beyond human beings to non-human beings.
But you have to ask the right question to get that answer. Professor Gallicott, what do you think of the basis of an environmental ethic? Does that work?
Actually, my question was, because I don't know anything about this, what is the environmental ethic?
Okay. All right.
I forgot to ask you
that. For a long time, I have thought along the lines of the analysis of ethics by Charles Darwin.
Charles?
No, Darwin. Darwin.
No. Okay.
Laurent's dog is named Darwin. So Darwin's very much a part of our lives these days. Darwin is usually thought of in terms of the struggle for existence and dog-eat-dog competition and that sort of thing. And that is a fair characterization of the origin of species, but his second great work, The Descent of Man, where he tries to extend evolutionary principles to explain virtually everything about human beings, to sort of bring Homo sapiens into the same account that he applies to all other species. And so one of the major problems that Darwin confronts is ethics, because it seems to run counter to what would seem obvious in natural selection. If there are limited resources and there's competition among us animals for these limited resources, it would seem that no rules in that competition would favor the strong over the weak, and you'd have just the usual sort of, survival of the fittest here. But Darwin points out that human beings survive, can really only survive in an intensely social context. We're not very well equipped, being slow, poorly armed, naked, and weak in comparison with other animals to survive on our own. We need to band together and pursue life's struggle collectively. But we cannot live together socially or in community unless we have principles of fairness, principles of cooperation, principles of mutual aid, all based on certain emotions that we evolved, like sympathy and loyalty and a sense of care and concern, which are then the foundation of these socially bonding behaviors. And that's the origin of ethics in Darwin's view. It is directly related to our to maintain the integrity of our societies or communities, outside of which it's impossible for us to survive and successfully reproduce as individuals. So the individual needs the society, and I like to think of ethics as the dues you pay in order to join society. It limits your take, but you get benefits that exceed the costs that you pay in the dues to join the community. So Darwin then envisions that as time goes on, small family societies, which are just extended families, parents and their children, siblings, cousins, grandparents, and second cousins, forming a group of about 50, then they're in competition with other such groups as they so well succeed because of their cooperative survival strategies, and that they start to merge into larger communities. And so then tribes come into existence, which are composed of a number of different clans, and then ethnic groups merge to compete with other ethnic groups. And by the time Darwin was writing, the limit of this this expansion of society and ethics had reached the nation-state scale. And even Darwin in 1878 or 1874, when The Descent of Man was published, envisioned a global society and a global ethic. But of course, that was not a reality in his own time. But I like to think of 1948 with the United Nations Declaration of Universal Human Rights is when, and this was after the Second World War, which was a nation-state conflict, that we formed the United Nations, that we recognized a sort of global society, we declared a global ethic, the ethic of universal human rights, and we affirmed this new ethic and this new society that we today call the Global Village. And it's only intensified since then. Now, what we learn from ecology is that we also are members of a multi-species society, which ecologists call the biotic community. So, if for every development and extension of social membership, there comes a corresponding ethic, that we now understand we're members of a biotic community, then that implies an environmental ethic that acknowledges our membership in the biotic community and the necessity of its species. And so that's really the basis of environmental ethics as I have explored it and as I have developed it. Now, there are other philosophers who developed environmental ethics in a very different way. But this is the view that I have championed, and I am very proud to say, very glad to say, that it is increasingly supported by evolutionary psychology, which is affirming this Humean, Darwinian understanding of ethics. They don't get into environmental ethics, but these base, these this philosophical foundation in the Humean and Darwinian tradition is now increasingly affirmed in a scientific context that's sometimes called moral psychology or evolutionary psychology. And so I feel very much vindicated because I was virtually alone in talking about all of these things, and now it's become mainstream, not in philosophy, but in, evolutionary psychology.
So but how many are you?
How many environmental philosophers are we?
Yeah.
Maybe 100 altogether, not all that many. But we seem to have a pretty, we have a bigger impact in our numbers, actually. In the United States, philosophy is dominated by something called Anglo-American analytic philosophy, and there are thousands of those, but nobody pays any attention to them outside their own community. So we have, our impact is far greater than our numbers, actually. But we pay a serious professional price for this because we are excluded from the academic centers of power and prestige. The world center of environmental philosophy is located at a third-rate institution, the University of North Texas, not at Harvard, not at Stanford, not at the University of Chicago, or the University of California, Berkeley, but second-rate state institution, and that's because it has not been accepted within the scholastic establishment of academic philosophy. And that used to trouble me a little bit, but it doesn't anymore, because I also noted that Descartes was excluded from the Sorbonne, and Galileo was in jail. So
it was like the 17th century.
Yeah, right. So the good philosophers have always been outside the academic centers of power and prestige.
Well, at least you're not in prison.
Well, I was for a day or two, not for environmental philosophy, but for civil rights activities in the 1960s, so. Who was it that said haven't really made a social contribution unless you've spent some time in the man's jail? So we can say that about Thoreau, about Martin Luther King, and so on. So
what is so fascinating of discussing all this with Bear is that he takes a very broad sweep of events, and so he gives hope to himself and to us that okay, might be difficult right now, but when you look and you take a broad perspective, you see that things are progressing nevertheless. Of course, it will be difficult, there will be still many hurdles, but you feel that kind of progression. And when you mentioned about Darwin, about Descartes, even if, in fact, your philosophy is contesting Descartes, you are totally against the dualism of Descartes, still, it helps to see that, in fact, environmental philosophy identifies a movement in society, let's say a thinking movement, which is much broader, for example, than just green parties. It's something which is much more profound. And time to emerge, but is emerging. Mm-hmm. And then that gives a very positive feeling despite the difficulties, mm-hmm. every day. Struggle.
Not in politics, but more in the
civil society.
In the commercial, industrial, and financial world.
Financial world?
Well, maybe not financial, but commercial, yeah. Corporate, mm-hmm. Global corporations are actually leading the way in making changes.
Yesterday we had
some of them.
A nice discussion with Steph Kranen, yeah. Of Nesso. If you want, by the way, to call him, I can give you his number. But it was very interesting because, of course, totally different from Baird, but you can feel a similar passion to promote a different vision of the world, and that's what basically drives them both.
Yeah, no, it was very the program last night. It wasn't as if you had two different worlds represented. It was like I was giving a big conceptual picture, and he was saying, this is the way it's applied, in one particular sort of domain. There are many other sorts of applications that we could find people in the energy sectors doing wind, solar, and that sort of thing as another domain of the application of similar ideas.
And also what is fascinating is this idea that, you know, right now we are just discussing the three of us, and you will write an article that will be read by other people, which might engage in discussions. Mm-hmm. And so it gives a feeling that despite the limited impact one might have with a talk, it contributes to a general discussion about those issues, which leads to change. Mm-hmm. So again, that's something
Everybody's optimistic
despite while recognizing the difficulties along
mm-hmm.
the way.
Yeah.
The big question, of course, is to know whether the changes we are advocating will materialize fast enough in order to prevent some catastrophes.
I'm very, very concerned about the potential for a severe catastrophe. I mean, mm-hmm. not like the financial crisis or anything like that, but on the order of a global failed state, you mm-hmm. know, where the world becomes globally Somalia and Yemen and mm-hmm. places, Afghanistan, where there's really no governance, no economy. You have marauding warlords, and you know, I mean, mm-hmm. The dark ages are around the corner. So believe me, I'm not just all, you know, wide-eyed optimist about all of this, but I think that having that looming as a real possibility gives a certain sense of urgency to making the kinds of reforms and making them fast that we're talking about around the table here. So let me assure you that I lay awake at night worrying about these things. My optimism is not pure by any means. I just think that having that as a kind of option, which no one would want to choose, but I mean it is an option, it will be the default option if we don't choose something else as we go forward. I fear, of course, I am too epistemologically restrained to think that, well, I know that this is going to happen if we don't make changes, you know, who knows what will happen. I mean, the world is very uncertain. I sometimes think in response to climate change, one of the things that the climate models don't take account of is the effect of clouds. But we know that with the warmer air, it holds more moisture, therefore forms more clouds, and the clouds might begin to reflect sunshine, you know, or so it might, there might be a natural sort of thermostatic response to increased temperature where you have something that will naturally work like geoengineering, you know, would be sense might kick in, and hey, we don't have a problem after all. I mean, that would be great. Who knows? I mean, I'm not prepared to say that, well, if we don't do this now, then this disaster is inevitable. But it's a real possibility, you know, and it's something that, you know, we have to take into account in terms of risk. And I think Laurent, in his professional capacity, is someone who professionally deals with risk, the idea of risk, and understands, you know, risk and preparing for it, that sort of thing. So,
again, when you heard Steve Kahneman, what is fascinating is that he said basically, I started to adopt Cradle to Cradle because I watched a documentary on television by two thinkers with a special philosophy, Cradle to Cradle, and themselves, they probably developed their ideas listening or reading people like Baird. I don't know who read, but whatever, it's not even important. The fact is that those ideas disseminate, and that you have some people.
They're public property.
And people like Steph implement them, that's their skills.
Yeah.
They don't do it just for profits. They do it also because somehow they are convinced they need to do so. But the wonderful thing is that it's not entangling with good business. Dassault is making a lot of profits doing so. So what is fascinating to me is that, once again, it's not, again, the earth versus business, versus the economy. It's much more subtle than that, provided we think a little bit about it, and that's exactly the type of contribution that Baird helps us to make.